20. An ornery diplomat. On November 9th, President Trump headed to Paris, where he was to join some of his Western counterparts for a weekend of ceremonies honoring the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Instead of being excited about a historic commemoration, Trump was brooding. The size of the Democratic majority in the House kept growing as some tight races were called later in the week, making Trump an all but certain target of intense Democratic oversight for his next 2 years in office. On top of that, Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker had predictably sparked controversy in the news, both because of his lack of basic qualifications for the job and sketchy business entanglements, and because of his public opposition to Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Speculation was rife that Whitaker, a partisan loyalist, would be Trump's hammer to whack away at the Mueller probe. As Trump headed to board Marine One to begin his journey to Paris, he snapped at the CNN correspondent Abby Phillip after she asked the pertinent question of the day. Did Trump want Whitaker to rein in Mueller? "What a stupid question that is," Trump replied. "What a stupid question. But I watch you a lot. You ask a lot of stupid questions." Trump did not answer Phillip's question. Once Trump boarded Air Force One for the 6.5-hour flight to France, he received a phone call from British Prime Minister Theresa May. Trump and May were not exactly chums. In July 2018, he famously bashed her handling of Brexit in an interview with the British tabloid The Sun, just as May was hosting him for a visit. But May tried much more than other European leaders to be deferential to Trump as part of the British government's long-view strategy of preserving the special relationship with the United States. May was calling Trump to congratulate him on his party's successes in the midterm elections. Of course, it was not lost on her that the Republicans lost control of the House, but she nevertheless sought to appeal to Trump's ego. It did not work. The ornery president blew up at the mannered prime minister. Trump berated May over Brexit and told her she was a lousy negotiator. He lit into her about trade deals with European countries that he considered unfair to the United States. It felt like a one-way conversation, with Trump doing most of the talking. Then, suddenly, he changed the topic and told her she must not have brought up Iran because she was ashamed of Britain's position. In fact, she hadn't raised Iran because it wasn't a scheduled topic of conversation. And besides, she could hardly get a word in. No, May told Trump, she was not ashamed. May had previously been subjected to Trump's erratic temper, but her aides were shaken by the acrimony of this call. They described it as the worst in May's career. The president was so churlish that a British official told The Telegraph that he had acted like Trump the Grump. The testy conversation set the tone for Trump's 43-hour visit to France. Upon arriving in Paris, Trump was whisked to the U.S. ambassador's residence, a handsome 19th-century manse in the heart of the city. He hunkered down inside, sulking about press coverage of his midterm losses and brooding about recounts in Florida, where his Republican allies would eventually be declared the winners in hotly contested gubernatorial and Senate races. The next morning, November 10th, Trump woke up early and, at 4:52 Paris time, tweeted a two-part defense of Whitaker. He was slated to attend a series of remembrance services and visit the Ain Marne American Cemetery, where 2,289 service members had been laid to rest at the foot of the hill where the Battle of Belleau Wood was waged. Inscribed on the wall of the memorial chapel are the names of 1,060 persons who were missing in action and whose bodies were not recovered. The cemetery grounds also included a monument to U.S. Marines. Trump would never see the cemetery. He told aides he did not feel like making the trek to Ain-Marne, which was roughly 55 miles from central Paris. The president had been scheduled to travel by helicopter, but it was raining and cloudy. And although the presidential helicopter is equipped to fly in most weather conditions, John Kelly and his deputy, Zach Fuentes, gave Trump an out. He could claim a weather call and cancel the cemetery visit. They explained that if they had to travel by motorcade, it would take an hour and a half and snarl traffic in parts of Paris and its surrounding suburbs. Trump leaped at the chance to pass on the cemetery visit. "I don't think I'm going to go," he said. Trump was scheduled to participate in other World War I commemorations over the weekend and figured it wouldn't be a big deal to skip this one. Kelly and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joseph Dunford, both Marines, decided to go in his stead and represent the U.S. delegation. Everything was going to be fine until Trump turned on the television. That's when he saw other dignitaries, including French President Emmanuel Macron, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, arriving in the rain at other memorial sites outside Paris. Back in the United States, cable news and social media were abuzz with commentary about Trump's decision to skip the ceremony because of rain. Democrats accused him of disrespecting fallen veterans. John Kerry, the former Secretary of State and a decorated Navy veteran, tweeted, "President, at real Donald Trump a no-show because of raindrops? Those veterans the president didn't bother to honor fought in the rain, in the mud, in the snow, and many died in trenches for the cause of freedom. Rain didn't stop them, and it shouldn't have stopped an American president." The criticism of Trump was worldwide and merciless. Nicholas Soames, a grandson of Winston Churchill's and a member of the British Parliament, called Trump pathetic and inadequate because he couldn't even defy the weather to pay his respects to the fallen. As was often the case with Trump's critics, the commentary got out of hand. There were suggestions from others that the president had skipped the cemetery visit simply because he was afraid to get his hair wet. Kelly and Dunford, meanwhile, appeared dignified and downright presidential as they toured the cemetery with a handful of other Americans and marked the anniversary. They stopped at the Marines' monument atop the hill to pay their respects. Kelly made solemn remarks there about his son Robert, a lieutenant in the U.S. Marines who had been killed in Afghanistan at age 29. As Trump saw Kelly getting positive attention for visiting the memorial, he erupted. He vented to aides that his absence made him look terrible in the media. "I could have fucking gone," Trump said. "I was willing to go. They're killing me for it." Trump took out his anger on Fuentes. "Your general should have convinced me to go," the president screamed at the deputy chief of staff, referring to Kelly. He faulted Kelly for not having the political savvy to foresee this public relations nightmare and for not persuading him to take the motorcade to the cemetery. "What a stupid decision," Trump told Fuentes.
"Sir, we made the best decision we could," Fuentes replied, not wanting to stoke the president by pushing back.
Later, talking to other advisors, Trump shirked any responsibility for bailing on the cemetery visit.
"It was John Kelly's decision that I couldn't go," Trump said. "I would have been happy to go. I don't care about the rain."
On November 11th, Trump was still smarting when he attended an Armistice Day ceremony at the foot of the Arc de Triomphe, the Roman-style arch that stands as the grandest war memorial in Paris. More than 60 world leaders attended to celebrate the 100th anniversary of bugles and church bells sounding throughout France to mark the end of World War I. Before the ceremony began,
Dozens of the visiting dignitaries marched shoulder to shoulder along the Champs-Élysées toward the arch as military jets left streaks of red, white, and blue smoke in the Parisian sky. But Trump did not participate in the march, nor did Russian President Vladimir Putin. They arrived at the arch instead via individual motorcades. Bundled up in a black overcoat, Trump took his seat next to Merkel, a few chairs down from Putin. Trump was in the unusual position of not being the center of attention. He was a mere guest. This was Macron's show. The choreography was consistent with the outsized role the French played in World War I relative to the United States, but Trump felt slighted to be given a less prominent role. Speaking French, Macron delivered a speech that journalists interpreted as a pointed rebuke of Trump as well as of Putin. "In the darkest hours of World War I," Macron said, "that vision of France as a generous nation, of France as a project, of France promoting universal values was the exact opposite of the egotism of a people who look after only their own interests, because patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. Nationalism is a betrayal of it. In saying, our interests first and who cares about the rest, you wipe out what's most valuable about a nation, what brings it alive, what leads it to greatness, and what is most important, its moral values." Macron warned that the old demons are reappearing and summoned the world's political leaders to break with the new treason of the intellectuals, which is at work and fuels untruths, accepts the injustice consuming our peoples, and sustains extremes and present-day obscurantism. Trump complained to advisors about Macron's speech, but didn't hit back. He attended a luncheon with the other world leaders and then gave a speech of his own at Suresnes American Cemetery and Memorial. Suresnes is closer to Paris than Aisne-Marne and was the resting place of 1,541 U.S. service members. Trump delivered a 10-minute speech in the rain, ditching his umbrella and joking that everyone was getting drenched, as if he were trying to make amends for the day before. "The American and French patriots of World War I embody the timeless virtues of our two republics, honor and courage, strength and valor, love and loyalty, grace and glory," Trump said. "It is our duty to preserve the civilization they defended and to protect the peace they so nobly gave their lives to secure one century ago." Trump then headed to the airport, where he boarded Air Force One for the flight home to Washington. The next day, November 12th, Veterans Day was observed in the United States, but Trump opted against paying his respects at Arlington National Cemetery, a tradition for presidents, something he later acknowledged he should have done. Instead, Trump spent the holiday inside the White House sulking about the poor media coverage of his Paris trip and tweeting about the prospect of presidential harassment by the Dems once they take control of the House in January. On November 13th, Trump came out swinging with an early morning Twitter broadside against Macron. He wrote, in reference to World Wars I and II, "They were starting to learn German in Paris before the U.S. came along." He assailed the French for not fair trade policies that make it more difficult to sell U.S. wines in France than to sell French wines in the United States. And he said Macron suffers from a very low approval rating in France. "By the way, there is no country more nationalist than France, very proud people, and rightfully so," Trump added. "Make France great again." Reading Trump's tweets in Paris, Macron was concerned. He immediately called his envoy in Washington, Gérard Araud, and asked what to do. The ambassador called one of his contacts in the White House, who advised, "Please, do nothing. He'll have this outburst, but afterwards, if you don't answer, it's over. Please tell Macron not to react, not to bother." This advisor explained that Trump had lashed out at Macron because of media coverage of the French president's speech. "Trump doesn't want to lose in the media, especially on Fox. If he appears weak on Fox, that's totally unacceptable." Ayrault passed this advice on to Paris, and Macron followed it. The Paris trip proved to be the final straw for Kelly. He would last in the job for less than a month after that. Trump's advisors could not tell how angry the president truly was at Kelly over the Paris debacle. One posited that he was just looking for an excuse to cut the cord. It felt like a wise time to change course. Fueling the president's feelings throughout the fall was a lobbying campaign from Kelly's internal enemies, including Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, to ditch him for a more politically minded chief of staff. The pressures were converging on Trump. He felt vulnerable. Robert Mueller's investigation was nearing an uncertain end. Nancy Pelosi intended to bring investigative heat on the president, if not eventually impeachment charges. More than 24 Democrats were gearing up to run to unseat him as president. And many of his longest-serving and most trusted staffers were gone or eyeing the exit. Ever since the gruesome murder on October 2nd of Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi dissident journalist who was a contributing columnist to The Washington Post, Trump and his administration had been on the defensive. Audio and video recordings obtained by the Turkish government showed that Khashoggi had walked into the consulate to obtain documents for his upcoming wedding, but was detained inside by a Saudi security team, then interrogated, tortured, killed, and dismembered with a bone saw. The operation was likely ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, whose government Khashoggi had criticized in his writings, according to U.S. intelligence analysis. Throughout October and early November, a mountain of evidence surfaced, but Trump and Kushner, who both had close personal relationships with MBS, still refused to hold the Saudis responsible for the murder, with the president even repeating MBS's denials. On November 16th, the case against the Saudis became even more definitive when the Post's Shane Harris, Greg Miller, and Josh Dossey reported that the CIA had concluded with high confidence that MBS had ordered Khashoggi's assassination. The CIA had also determined that Khalid bin Salman, the Saudi ambassador to the United States and the crown prince's brother, had called Khashoggi at MBS's direction to instruct him to go to the consulate in Istanbul to retrieve his wedding documents and to assure him he would be safe doing so. In response, the Trump administration imposed small economic sanctions on 17 Saudis who U.S. intelligence operatives believed were responsible for the act, but did not implicate MBS. Many U.S. lawmakers said the sanctions were woefully insufficient punishment for the crime. Senator Rand Paul, a Republican ally of Trump's, tweeted in response, "We are pretending to do something and doing nothing." Meanwhile, Trump cast doubt on the CIA's assessment by telling reporters it was very premature and boasting about Saudi Arabia as a truly spectacular ally. Throughout the fall, the president's lawyers had had reason to feel they were in the catbird seat. With Mueller's capitulation to take some answers from Trump in writing, they were confident their client wasn't going to be subpoenaed to testify. The agreement to provide answers only about Russian interference, the central reason for Mueller's appointment, and only pertaining to the time until the November 2016 election, was favorable. However, Even within these narrow confines, the possible questions were numerous. Did Trump receive regular briefings from Michael Cohen as he pursued the Moscow-Trump Tower deal? When did he first learn about WikiLeaks having damaging Democratic emails? Did he know anything about Donald Trump Jr.'s being offered a meeting about dirt on Hillary Clinton? Throughout September and October, Trump's lawyers kept telling the public that they were working with the president to complete the written answers to Mueller, but the reality is they were having significant trouble getting time with their client, even though he spent many hours a day watching television. As his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, often told reporters, their client was the president, and he was pretty busy. On October 24th, Trump's lawyers planned to sit down with their client to go over the written answers. They were only about 25 minutes into the meeting when their session came to an abrupt end. Trump's national security and federal law enforcement teams needed to give him a briefing about pipe bombs that had been mailed to several prominent Democrats, including former President Obama and Hillary Clinton. Giuliani and Jay Sekulow, along with Jane and Martin Raskin, were drafting Trump's answers on his behalf based on a rolling series of meetings with him to go over his recollections. They had most of them drafted by Halloween and considered the answers, so far, pretty uncontroversial. On the morning of November 1st, Sekulow went to the White House for another sit-down with Trump to finalize answers. But the president was interrupted by calls from Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Chinese President Xi Jinping. "There goes my meeting," Sekulow said with a sigh. As eager as Trump's lawyers were to complete the answers, they had not wanted to submit them before the November 6th midterm elections. But after the GOP's crushing loss of its House majority, the lawyers faced a new challenge. Trump was in a sour mood, especially after he returned from Paris on November 12th, and seemed to get testy when they brought up the subject of the Mueller questions. Then, two things happened the week before Thanksgiving, one right after the other, which spooked them. First, sometime around November 15th, Sekulow received a strange email from what looked like a fictitious account. It contained a short note that said something along the lines of, "This is very important. You may want to see it." Attached were several documents. Sekulow was afraid to open the attachments, suspicious that it might be a setup. "You're the criminal lawyer, so tell us what to do," he said to Giuliani. Together with the Raskins, they decided to open the documents. "They were shocking," Giuliani recalled. "Everything we expected." One of the attachments was a copy of a draft plea agreement that Mueller's office had written as part of its ongoing negotiations with Jerome Corsi. Corsi was a longtime Clinton critic and ally of Roger Stone, an off-and-on political advisor to Trump for the previous decade. Prosecutors wanted to know how Stone correctly predicted that WikiLeaks' Julian Assange would leak damaging emails about Clinton in 2016, and they suspected Corsi might provide the missing link. An email from August 2, 2016, showed that Corsi, who was traveling in Europe at the time, alerted Stone to the planned release by their friend in embassy, an apparent reference to Assange, who, since 2012, had been living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. "Word is, friend in embassy plans two more dumps," Corsi had written. "One, shortly after I'm back. Second, in October. Impact planned to be very damaging." What surprised Sekulow and the president's other lawyers was that Mueller's draft plea agreement, which Corsi was refusing to sign, specifically referred to Trump. Mueller wanted Corsi to acknowledge that Stone had asked him during the campaign to reach out to WikiLeaks, referred to as Organization One in the document, to find out what material they still had to release. The agreement said Corsi understood that Stone was asking because he was in regular contact with senior members of the Trump campaign, including with then-candidate Donald J. Trump. Corsi complained, through his lawyer, that he felt railroaded into signing this agreement and that Mueller's investigators told him that they planned to indict him if he didn't admit the truth. Trump's lawyers thought that was playing hardball, but also found the reference to Trump in the plea agreement draft worrisome. They told their client, and the president instructed them, make sure you give it to the FBI right away. The second event happened late on the night of November 15th. It started with chatter on Twitter that some mysterious documents showed federal prosecutors had indicted Assange under seal, possibly earlier that year. Due to the mistaken filing, the sealed charges had been mentioned in a court document on a public website. In the document, prosecutors wrote that the unexplained charges would need to remain sealed until Assange is arrested in connection with the charges in the criminal complaint and can therefore no longer evade or avoid arrest and extradition in this matter. Trump's legal team found these developments unsettling, and they wondered whether Mueller was plotting to expand or extend his investigation into a new, untapped vein. They groused about documents being mishandled and concerns about prosecutors leaking damaging material. But their central fear was that Mueller's probe might be ramping up rather than closing down. The lawyers demanded a meeting with Mueller's team and with his supervisor, Rod Rosenstein, to discuss their concerns about the Trump reference in the Corsi document and the inadvertent Assange filing. Giuliani, Sekulow, and Jane Raskin all felt strongly that Mueller should be there, so Giuliani specifically requested Mueller personally explain his office's actions. They also wanted the special counsel's Justice Department overseers to be present. Somebody had to know how they were behaving, Giuliani said. A few days before Thanksgiving, Trump's lawyers arrived at Rosenstein's conference room at the Justice Department. In walked James Quarles, Aaron Zebley, and Andrew Goldstein of the special counsel's office. Rosenstein was out of town and was represented by Ed O'Callaghan, but Mueller was a no-show. His deputies said he couldn't attend, but provided no reason. The Trump lawyers were flabbergasted that their concern didn't rate as important enough to command Mueller's presence. They later wondered if Mueller was ill, presuming it was the only reason he would skip an important meeting with opposing counsel. We weren't repping some minor player. We were representing the President of the United States, recalled one of Trump's lawyers. We are meeting with the deputy in his conference room. Mueller wouldn't even talk with us. The meeting got off to a hostile start. You're not conducting an investigation, Giuliani told the special counsel trio. You're conducting a complete frame-up focused on one person, Donald Trump. This is an outrage, and the Justice Department will be disgraced by this. At one point, Sekulow said something along the lines of, you're trying to squeeze this old guy to flip another guy against my client. Quarles led the defense. You're mischaracterizing it, he responded to Giuliani. O'Callaghan tried to calm Trump's lawyers. Rudy, I've been briefed on this, he said. I know where this is going. It's not about flipping Corsi to open up another avenue of the investigation. It's just not. Despite Mueller's absence, the meeting ultimately helped to smooth over anxieties. The special counsel lawyers insisted they had nothing to do with the Assange leak and that it had been an electronic filing mistake by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Virginia. They said they couldn't get into a lot of details about the Corsi agreement, but that there was nothing untoward about making clear this related to the Trump campaign and Trump's candidacy. As the meeting wrapped up, Giuliani told the special counsel team that they would take a little interruption right now in deciding on submitting the answers. But on November 20th, Trump's lawyers submitted the president's answers to Mueller's questions. They had successfully persuaded Trump to repeatedly use a phrase he had ardently resisted uttering over the years, "I do not recall." In his written submission, drafted by his lawyers but approved by Trump, the president provided 22 answers to Mueller questions on four main subjects: the Trump Organization's proposed tower in Moscow, Russia's interference in the 2016 election, the Trump campaign, and contacts by Trump allies with Russians during the campaign. In 19 of his 22 answers, Trump said he couldn't remember enough to answer some or all of the questions. Regarding the infamous June 2016 Trump Tower meeting between Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and a Russian lawyer, Trump said in his answers to Mueller that he didn't recall whether he learned about it before or after it happened, whether he knew about Trump Jr.'s work to set it up, or whether he spoke with Trump Jr., Kushner, or Manafort on the day of the meeting. Asked if he was told by anyone during the campaign that Putin supported his candidacy, Trump replied, "I have no recollection of being told." But in July 2018, Trump had reacted to news reports about the meeting by denying any knowledge of it. He tweeted, "I did not know of the meeting with my son, Don Jr." One thing Trump told Mueller he could remember from that time was that he was aware of reports indicating that Putin had made complimentary statements about him. Had Mueller secured a face-to-face interview with Trump, he or others on his team might have been able to press the president with follow-up questions or bring evidence to his attention to rejigger his memory and better get the truth out of him. But that was not to be. As Mueller would later write in his report on the investigation, "We viewed the written answers to be inadequate."